Off the Ball Daily,
a home for your favourite podcasts from Off the Ball.
I was almost surprised when Taylor's hand was raised at the end, because you could feel Serrano coming on strong. Katie Taylor was a very much more of a clear winner.
Subscribe to the Off the Ball Daily podcast feed right now.
Off the Ball Daily.
All right, so over the past few days, we've obviously begun to digest properly the verdict in the Conor McGregor civil trial, where he was found liable for assault. And we wanted to have a conversation about a number of different things, about our role models in sport, out of sport, how views of women, especially amongst our young men in this country, are being affected by them. And I'm delighted to say that Sarah Benson, CEO of Women's Aid, is with us here in studio. Sarah, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me in.
Before we get into a number of these talking points, I think it's just worthwhile just mentioning Nikita Hand before all of this, and just the levels of bravery and all the different things that she had to deal with over the past few months, whether it was a lack of anonymity in this trial, whether it was the fact that she had to recount some of the details that she had to recount in this. And on top of all of this, the profile of all of this, given the person that the case was being taken against. Sure, it was a positive outcome for her in the end, in that one moment, and it's great to see some sort of catharsis for her in that moment. But to say it was a tough number of weeks and a number of years for her would be putting it unbelievably mildly.
Yeah, I mean, you've said it all there, and I couldn't agree more. I think this trial had a lot of echoes of the Belfast rape trial, where in Northern Ireland, you know, criminal cases were not under what's called in camera, because this was a civil case. Everything was aired. And not only that, the name of the woman at the centre of the case was named, so known publicly in a small country, flanked by journalists the entire time, had the courage to stand up and say, no, what happened was wrong, and you know, I'm willing to say my piece. But the stakes are terribly high, and I think, you know, even things that have emerged afterwards as to the pressure that she felt under, you know, in her own home, in terms of her own sense of safety, her family's safety, because perhaps of the profile of the person accused in the civil case, you can't really quantify. And we hope in Women's Aid, more than anything, that, you know, now that this is over, is that there's due regard for that amongst the public, amongst the community. I know at the moment, you know, there's great positive response, but I know for every positive response, there's also, you know, backlash. And I hope that those close to her, or those in a position to support her family now and for the foreseeable future, will be there for her, and that the resources, I know our colleagues in the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre were with her every single day in the court, and they're very committed to providing ongoing assistance, because the trauma in the aftermath of these things can go on and on and on. It's not just the experience that she had at the hands of Conor McGregor, but the actual process of the case itself can be incredibly traumatic.
Your experience over the past 5 days or so, do you get feedback from people who have used the services of Women's Aid down through the years that this has been an unbelievably triggering thing for them, not just the last few weeks, but also, as you mentioned, some of the details that have come out after the verdict, even the response from McGregor and his family after that? I presume that will be quite a triggering thing for people to experience as well.
I think that one of the things that is most triggering is the attitudes towards victims that was showing up in certain quarters online, and what that did for anyone who has a lived experience of, be it domestic violence, coercive control, sexual abuse and assault, which of course can happen in the context of intimate relationships as well, is that feeling extremely fragile, feeling very vulnerable, feeling, you know, absolutely on tenterhooks, awaiting the actual outcome to see, will this woman be believed? Because I'm frightened that I will never be believed. And, you know, speaking to, you know, we have the National Domestic Violence Helpline, the Rape Crisis Centre have the National Sexual Violence Helpline, all of us receiving calls, you know, where that level of anxiety and stress, and at the same time hearing Nikita's words triggering, you know, lived experience that, you know, many, many other women have had, you know, in different contexts, be it at the hands of a friend or in, you know, the person who they're actually in an intimate relationship with. It absolutely has ripples, these cases.
In the case, obviously, we got a lot more information afterwards with regards to the version of Conor McGregor that presented himself in court. And he was fairly belligerent in court with regards to the certain details, and obviously, I mean, to use his own language in court, he described what happened between himself and Nikita Hand as enthusiastic, vigorous, prolonged and athletic sex, and it was as if he was sort of trying to portray himself as this UFC fighter again, almost in that setting. That was certainly one of the elements that I think a lot of people would have taken from this trial. This was not a contrite man who was trying to play down the interactions between himself and the woman.
Yeah, and I read some of the coverage of that at the time, and some of it, I think, tried to capture the feeling that that actually was picked up in the room. I think it was described as that there was a bit of a stunned silence after that. And in some ways, I take heart from reading something like that because, you know, it gives one the impression, and I think the jury obviously saw this as well, is that this is somebody whose attitude, sense of entitlement to women, to anything they want in life, you know, is so internalized that they would sit on the stand and say that to the face of the woman who they know and the jury believe he had assaulted. And, you know, I think that that is his brand and has been his brand, is that dominance is everything and dominance is strength. You know, vulnerability is, you know, nothing more than you know, weakness. And everything he appears to do in life is living that. And, you know, for the people around him and the people who he comes in contact with, if he has that attitude, you know, it is experiences like Nikita Han suffered. But it's also sending a really negative message, you know, particularly to young men about what it is to be a man. You know, Conor McGregor, you know, when you take a step back, almost looks like a pastiche of something, you know, from, you know, decades ago. And yet at the same time, with things like social media, with, you know, algorithms pulling boys in particular down, you know, rabbit holes, they're bringing them to the likes of McGregor as a role model, when actually, you know, this brash, you know, kind of armor plated, completely self-focused, without regard for the well-being or the entitlement or the consent of the person he is with, is really quite frightening.
Yeah, and I should say as well that there will be an appeal, and Conor McGregor has every right to appeal his case on that. Just one last point on that. I thought Eilish O'Hanlon summed it up really well in The Independent at the weekend. Justice Owens left it up to the jury to decide if McGregor was telling the truth or concocting a lurid and degrading pornographic fantasy about a woman who had accused him of rape. Is it any wonder Ms. Hand was left feeling like a lump of meat? And as I say, Conor McGregor has absolutely every right to defend himself in the situation, and he will continue to do so in the future. But it's almost the prolonging of the hell for the complainant in the situation.
Yeah, I mean, I like the legal process is the legal process. And I think what we have is, at this particular moment in time, we have a verdict that's handed down, and that's what we're working with. But that is why I mentioned the need after cases like these. And, you know, Nikita Hand is publicly known now, in part because, you know, the perpetrator in this case, the person who's been found liable. But every day in court, there are cases that are travelling through where, you know, victims, mostly women, but also men, of sexual assault and rape are having to live through, you know, traumatic processes. And the impact of the event itself doesn't end afterwards. But as I say, you know, and it bears repeating, because people don't realise just how traumatic the impact of a trial itself is. So, you know, it's being discussed now in the media, but next week, next month, you know, survivors are left picking up the pieces after the outcomes of cases, and really can, you know, require long-term support and therapeutic support to find their way through it. I mean, extraordinary resilient survivors, but they are entitled to the support of the society that they're in.
It's good timing, for lack of a better phrase, because I know that you had published research just last week, right, with regards to traditionalist views in men, how prominent they are, and the ages of those who lean towards more, in inverted commas, traditionalist views towards women. The phrase that we've kind of used a couple of times here in terms of dominance with regards to the opposite sex, that was also something that cropped up quite a bit in your own research that you've published.
Yeah, this was like extraordinary timing. It was literally the day before the verdict came in. We launched this report in the context of Women's Aid's 50th anniversary. Our partners, CORE, research conducted this study for us, and it's building on work that was conducted by the Men's Development Network a couple of years ago, which is the man survey, which is looking at men's attitudes towards masculinity and what it is to be a man, towards women. And so this was a nationally representative survey. It also surveyed women as well, but the particular focus was men's own attitudes. And what it found was, on the one hand, you know, the positive findings that if you have five men, you know, sitting around this table, three of them will have much more moderate views, that will, they won't necessarily agree with the kind of traditional perspectives of dominance, or that men should be the primary earners, or that, you know, showing strength even, or, you know, never showing fear, never showing emotions when you're under pressure or scared are positive things. So that's good news. But there's two men, you know, in that group who are espousing those much more traditionalist views. And what really stood out in the report is that the vast majority of them are young men, so men under 30. And that, I think, speaks to a lot of the kind of discourse, but also that shift to the influence and perhaps outsized influence of online and social media platforms. This is where younger men are getting their messaging from. They're spending much more time there to engage with their peers, find role models, find news. And as I mentioned before, there is a responsibility amongst the social media platforms themselves, because research has shown, done by DCU, that boys engaging with just YouTube and TikTok, within a very few short clicks, they may be looking up something about their favourite football club, very quickly brought down really dark misogynistic content to people like McGregor, who are espousing this idea that young men should feel alienated, that they are disadvantaged, that, you know, anger is really the only valid emotion, that to be authentic and be successful is to be strong and to only show strength. And that, that also includes in how they behave in their intimate relationships in a domineering, unequal fashion.
Why do you think that's a compelling thing for young men? Why do you think they are taken by that argument?
It's a really difficult. I don't think it's a simple answer, but I think if you look at the example of, say, the United States in the recent election, what they saw there amongst younger voters was a pull towards much more liberal views amongst young women and a pull in the opposite direction amongst young men. And I, part of the way I was trying to explain it last week is that I think that there's a difference between, like, the facts and the feelings. In reality, we still live in a gender unequal society. You know, we have less female representation at all levels in politics and business. Women do still earn less everywhere. Being a subject to gender-based violence, the single biggest risk factor is being born female. And yet at the same time, there is some young men who are feeling alienated and disadvantaged, or feeling that, you know, they're being blamed for these things. And I think what the research tells us also is, you know, there are ways that we can try and push back against the likes of, you know, a role model like McGregor, who, it's not just bad for women, it's also bad for men. You know, they're not being, you know, supported to be authentic, to be vulnerable, to be emotional. And the concerns in the report that were raised by the three out of five men who fall into that more moderate category were quite different to those that were articulated by the two in five who were traditional. The three in five were more concerned about, you know, about vulnerability, about loneliness, about connection, whereas the two in five focus much more on feeling pressure to provide for the family or to be the main breadwinner, and discomfort with expressing vulnerability. So almost exact opposites. And their attitudes towards relationships were polar opposite, where almost, you know, very, very few men in the three out of five, the moderate group, agreed with concepts like, you know, men should always use dominance to get what they need, that women's issues are exaggerated, that, you know, taking women's views into account in relationships is not, you know, that you shouldn't need to do that. Whereas the majority of those who fell into the traditionalist camp did hold those views. But what I think the opportunity is that the more older men, more men who actually are the fathers and the uncles, that age group of the younger men, are in the moderate category. So there is a great opportunity there to speak to them and speak in a non-blaming way, and to have conversations that start with, how do you feel? Like, you know, what worries you? What scares you about your life? You know, what are your hopes and dreams for the future? And have authentic conversations. Point to other positive role models. I mean, the GAA, I think, have done a remarkable thing this week, and this being Off the Ball, is they launched an amazing initiative called Game Changer, which is part of a four-year commitment in partnership with the Men's Development Network and the support organisation Rahama, to bring the GAA on a journey to tackle gender-based violence and promote equality, starting, you know, at club level, through raising awareness, starting conversations. And there are, you know, members across ladies football, camogie, hurling and football, who are standing as ambassadors for that. These are amazing role models, sportsmen and sportswomen. So they are out there. So we just need to redirect that focus.
For sure. The age thing is fascinating. Obviously, the elephant in the room with regards to why younger people have more traditional views than, say, their elders is obviously technology. And that's a very, very simple explaining factor. But there might be other factors as well, right? I do wonder, even like, and this can bring us nicely onto the idea of the role model in terms of the type of role model that has existed in recent years. Granted, they are being projected into your technology much more readily, but even if we use the case of McGregor as an example, it definitely felt that his views as an individual, and this is just me just reading the situation, hardened quite a bit during the pandemic, where even in the very early stages of COVID, you had a situation where McGregor was one of these people who was trying to help Ireland get through this, you know, trying to get all health supplies into the country and push things forward. Over time, that became a more sceptical view on what the country was trying to do. And then obviously we saw his own political views come to the fore last year. It does feel that that shift, that whole societal shift towards those sorts of views on a political sense and on a societal sense, are just more present now than they were maybe even 20 years ago. I could be totally wrong on that, but it feels that there is a societal thing here that is being pushed into people's faces via technology, as opposed to just blaming the technology itself.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot in that. I think, you know, to your kind of earlier comment in terms of like people's views around kind of, is society working? Is, you know, are we failing? You know, is the mainstream failing? And look, that's actually being interrogated all across the globe at the moment. You see democracy being interrogated. You see shifts to more authoritarian views. In some ways, it feels like, you know, when we talk about traditionalist, you know, we're very careful not to use terms like toxic masculinity and things like that. That's reductive, and it speaks only about individuals. Traditional is, you know, a pull back into, you know, what have been, you know, centuries long established kind of rules, you know, for men, for women. And in that we have deeply unequal societies. But there is that retreat into the kind of the security of the stereotype, maybe. In the short term, that may make some people feel better, but what it does is it tends to other others, and it tends not to really open us up to the progress that we have made, and recognizing that, you know, opening ourselves up to including others, to having, you know, relationships that may be a bit more work because they involve compromise over dominance, but actually in the end are much richer, much more emotionally rewarding. That's slower work, and that's where that kind of, to come back to the three and five men, that's the journey they seem to be on. So if we can get the three and five to engage with the two and five, and I really do think it's important to put it in context, is, you know, engaging men is really important, but it is in the context of, you know, huge structural inequalities. This will be, you know, bringing around a much more gender equal society is going to be good for men. It is really going to be better for women, because, you know, when we're talking about somebody of that level of profile as Conor McGregor, you know, like, you know, gazing out directly into the eyes of the person who he has done, you know, terrible things to, and, you know, displaying such a sense of entitlement and kind of satisfaction with, you know, his view of how he behaved. That's really something we need to pay attention to, because, you know, a smaller number can do a lot of damage.
Yeah, and also paying attention to what the knock-on impact is for his fans, if there is going to be any knock-on impact. It seems like an absurd thing to say out loud, given the verdict last week, but we have seen in many, many cases of varying levels of severity in recent years where outcomes and facts don't actually alter opinions all that much. I think Andrew Tate is possibly a great example to use this, where the fans of Andrew Tate wouldn't exactly be like, I'm hopping off the bandwagon now because I've found out more grim information about this man. Quite often they are hardened. So when it comes to actually changing the views, changing the three versus two here, that's, I suspect, a very, very difficult thing to challenge, given a lot of the people who might be on the aforementioned bandwagon are unbelievably hardened in their opinions.
I think one of the reasons they're hardened, and yeah, look, I mean, Andrew Tate and his brother are like actively accused of sex trafficking and yet still have a following. And that's a hard concept to grapple with. But I think what's missing there is the other voice or the other engagement with young men in particular. And that's where the opportunity is. But we need to be realistic around, you know, as I mentioned, there's algorithms. I think the social media platforms have a huge level of accountability. It's quite gendered as well. Young girls are being dragged down rabbit holes that lead them to eating disorders, that lead them to, you know, concepts of, you know, that girls need to be ready to perform in, you know, in the way that pornography displays sex, which, you know, is not you know, respectful sexual engagement. And pornography itself is the other gigantic elephant in the room. Women's Aid actually launched a research report a couple of weeks prior to this report, looking at how our young people's sexual scripts are being groomed from a very young age before they ever actually engage in any sexual contact by pornography. So boys, you know, groomed to believe that men, you know, engage sexually in a way that is domineering, degrading, violent, and girls are being groomed that this is what is expected of them, to be done to them. So it's nothing to do with it being enjoyable for the girl, and you know, it's also so all of those things are in the mix. And I think what we need to do is kind of take a step back. It's not one individual role model or two. It is, you know, a huge exposure online to things like pornography that dovetail then with the attitudes around dominance and, you know, domination, including over women, that are espoused by certain role models. And that's where, you know, as a society, looking really holistically at opportunities to engage men and boys in conversations also with girls, to hear and listen to each other's worries and experiences. And that seems to unlock almost magically, and to huge relief of both boys and girls, this idea is that, okay, that isn't the script that we need to follow. We need our SPHE and, you know, education curriculum to centre on equality, even when people are different from each other. And as I mentioned, those conversations to have with boys, to give them a space, because they actually, when men have them and they we're discussing this, boys just need somebody to validate them, to hear them, and also to help them, you know, guide them into, you know, ways to have healthy, you know, friendships, which will lead to relationships, and also to be whoever they want to be as well, not just, you know, an MMA fighter.
One last question on this then. The concept of a role model, this is probably more of a conversation that we won't find any real conclusion to, but the theory is often out there that we shouldn't see our sports people as role models because they are good at sport and they haven't necessarily got the life tools or anything else to necessarily espouse the values that a lot of people would want, say, their young people to actually witness. I wonder, should we be ignoring that entirely and actually promoting positive role models as opposed to just shutting them down as with regards to their ability to influence and dictate the behaviours of other people? Like, I'm not sure myself. I'm not sure, should we divorce these two things, or should we continue to prop these people up, put them on that pedestal, but just highlight the positives, the great, great role models within sport, for example?
Well, I don't think we can pick and choose, because I think what we have to put in context is sport is a really obvious example, because you have sometimes very, very particularly young men, if you look at the Premiership, you know, who are being paid extraordinary sums of money and then also uplifted by the media. And that is, you know, their jerseys with their names are on them. You know, they're getting airtime, you know, for their skill in a particular sport, but also as brand ambassadors. So if they're being uplifted like that, they absolutely are role models. We're making them role models. And that does bring a responsibility either to support sports people to, you know, to take that on board and really internalize, and or not to uplift them in that way. And I don't think, I think absolutely we need to highlight the positive role models. But it, the broader principle is if you have a public profile, whether it's in sport or somewhere else, there is a level of accountability that is above, you know, the person who's driving your bus, or, you know, if you have a public profile, you have an audience and you have a responsibility, particularly if, you know, a huge proportion of your audience is young people and impressionable young people. So I think that, yeah, we can't set that aside. And we do have to say that sports people are role models and there should be some level of accountability for that.
Just before I let you go, obviously, the country is going to the polls on Friday and the conversation around domestic, sexual and gender-based violence hasn't exactly been front and centre of this campaign. Just briefly looking through the manifestos a little bit earlier on, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are strikingly similar on a couple of things on this. The three major parties all have one page, basically, on this topic. They, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, refer to a domestic violence disclosure scheme. They're both in favour of bringing that in. Sinn Féin, meanwhile, talk about a dedicated rape crisis centre and more funding in that regard. From what you've seen from those three manifestos, is it positive steps that we will see from whatever the makeup of the new government is, or is it still a bit away from where you'd like it to be in terms of the importance of the conversation?
Yeah, we've read all of the manifestos, actually, not just those three. And while domestic, sexual and gender-based violence does feature to a greater or lesser extent in all, no parties have made it their number, like in their top five priority. We have a national strategy, a third national domestic, sexual and gender-based violence strategy. We have made huge strides in recent years in terms of legislation, in terms of finally starting to uplift, you know, the domestic and sexual violence specialist services. I've been really dismayed to hear some commentary, you know, which is claiming that domestic, sexual and gender-based violence, for example, should be like referred to as a woke issue in the context of the criminal justice system or justice in general. It is something that costs billions, that, you know, destroys lives, in some cases costs lives. It is one of the number one policing responses, domestic violence, 57,000 call-outs already this year. So we want to see, you know, the furthering and the commitment at all of government level to, you know, combating domestic, sexual and gender-based violence as a firm commitment in the next programme for government. So not small initiatives. We want the continuation of the support of the plan from the Taoiseach across all of government. It shows up in housing, in health, in justice, in education, everywhere. So certainly when we start to see who's going to be forming the next government, we and our colleagues will be calling on them to make sure that we maintain that momentum.
All right. Sarah Benson, CEO of Women's Aid, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Off the Ball Daily.